This week we're staring across the seas at... where exactly? Well, continental Europe, really, though not the Nordic nations. They, more or less, are on our side. We being the English-speaking world, and our side being what's known as analytical philosophy, as opposed to continental philosophy. If you're an analytical philosopher, all that French and German stuff looks vague, verbose, and romantic. If you're sitting in Paris, the analytical stuff is likely to seem abstract, dry, and quite unconnected with human realities. Welcome to the Philosopher's Zone. I'm Alan Saunders, and I exaggerate, of course. But there is a real division here, and it was addressed recently at the Sydney Writers Festival by Paul Patton. He's Professor of Philosophy at the University of New South Wales. He holds a doctorate from the University of Paris, 8, and here he is talking about a few things that are, he says, close to his heart.
Commentators tend to point out that it is a complex and indeed a contested term, in part because it's bound up with a series of other dichotomies and stereotypes that form part of our culture, like the difference between English and European culture, or cultures more generally, or like the difference between the two cultures that C.P. Snow wrote about at the end of the 1950s, the culture of science and the culture of the humanities. And I'll say a bit more about those. One of the simplest ways to understand the term would be to take it as a geographic, or as one French philosopher, Jean-Luc Nancy, put it, an ethno-geographic category, whereby continental philosophy would be the kind of philosophy that is done by continental Europeans, whether on the continent or elsewhere. The problem with that, of course, is that it doesn't take into account the degree to which what goes under the name of continental philosophy has taken on a life of its own beyond the borders of continental Europe, North America, Britain, Australia, and Asia. Nor does this ethnogeographic interpretation take into account the important contributions made by Europeans to the flourishing of analytic philosophy, in particular the founders of logical positivism and indeed of the analytic tradition in contemporary philosophy were mostly German speakers, beginning with Frege, Carnap, and others. But this tradition of analytical or logical philosophy performed in Europe by European thinkers continues up to the present. So a more helpful way to understand the term might be to think of it in historical and perhaps methodological terms, to think then of continental philosophy as a kind of umbrella term for a whole series of traditions or orientations within modern philosophy, which for the purposes of this I take to mean philosophy, European philosophy, since Kant. And one could list a number of such traditions or orientations, and I'll read out a list, which, by the way, I've simply taken from a very good short introductory book by Simon Critchley, an English philosopher, Continental Philosophy, A Very Short Introduction, which I cannot help but add as an aside. He wrote in Sydney when as a visiting scholar at the University of Sydney in 2000. So his list of these traditions includes, firstly, German idealism and romanticism, Fichte, Schelling, Hegel, Novalis, Schopenhauer. Secondly, the tradition of German anti-materialist and materialist thinkers that, and their successors, so typically Feuerbach, Marx, Nietzsche, and in France, Bergson. Thirdly, the tradition of phenomenology and existential philosophy in both their German and French forms, the work of people like Husserl, Heidegger, Sartre, Merleau-Ponty, Simone de Beauvoir, Emmanuel Levinas. Fourthly, the hermeneutic tradition of Dilthey, Gadamer, Paul Ricoeur. Fifthly, the school of critical theory, or sometimes called Western Marxism or the Frankfurt School, that includes Adorno, Horkheimer, Lukács, Marcuse, Habermas, and more recently, Axel Honneth. And finally, the predominantly French tradition of structuralism and post-structuralism that covers people like Althusser, Lacan, Foucault, Deleuze, Derrida, and Irigaray. So that would be another way to understand it, simply as a list of traditions and approaches. The problem with this, as Critchley points out, is that it covers such a wide range of diverse approaches that it becomes rather difficult to see what they all have in common. And Critchley suggests, indeed, that this makes it clear that the very term continental philosophy is a kind of Anglophone or Anglocentric projection onto the work of others, others who wouldn't necessarily recognise themselves in this way. As Critchley says, it would be rather like asking for a continental breakfast in Paris or in Berlin. A further advantage of understanding the term in this way as a kind of Anglocentric projection, or simply as a generic term for what other philosophers, non-Anglo-American or non-analytic philosophers, do, is that it enables us to appreciate how much the term is overlain with a series of other cultural stereotypes, all of which contribute something to the popular understanding, but none of which coincide with it exactly. So, for example, I mentioned at the beginning C.P. Snow's two cultures, the culture of the sciences and, as he put it, the culture of the literary intellectuals. And this is a division that's still very much alive in the contemporary university. Alan mentioned my other day job as Associate Dean Research. And when in that capacity I have to talk to Associate Deans for research from the sciences, they often look mystified when we talk about research in the humanities and say, but what do you do? I mean, what new facts do you people discover? And so on. So the C.P. Snow's two cultures are still alive and well. The problem with that is that it's not just continental philosophers, but indeed all philosophers who get lumped in with the literary intellectuals. Another deep-seated dichotomy that sometimes overlaps with the analytic continental divide is the perceived cultural divide between the honest, plain-spoken, business-like culture of the English-speaking world and the less honest, the flowery and somewhat effete airs of European culture. This, of course, applies particularly to the French and the Latins. The Germans are an exception, but they have their own cultural defects, woolly abstraction, mysticism, and so on. These stereotypes, of course, embody the kind of Anglocentric sense of superiority that was expressed in the famous headline in the Times, "Fog over the Channel, continent cut off." But they are stereotypes that are alive and well. They still find expression in philosophers' own self-perception. For example, in a recent prize-winning broadcast on ABC Radio, All in the Mind, in 2006, a discussion of the philosophy of the Australian tradition of the philosophy of mind, which is a proud and distinguished tradition, one of the discussants, in response to the question, why is it that Australian philosophers have played such a prominent role in defending materialist theories of the mind, responded by reporting the widespread view that, I quote, "The trouble when you study philosophy in other parts of the world, especially somewhere like England, there's just so much fog and mist and so forth outside. People tend to believe that the world is ethereal and they never really get out and do the hard work. Whereas in Australia, in the hard light," and here Natasha Mitchell interjected a comment about the beach, "in the hard light, it just exposes everything. We're forced to look at the world as it really is, and it means that we can be honest about that and we can really get down and do some important work." Now, these ideas are quite common and amongst philosophers of all stripes. They form part of what one French philosopher, Michel Leduf, called the philosophical imaginary, by which she meant the images, the metaphors, the figures of speech in terms of which philosophers make sense of who they are and what they do. And it's quite surprising and indeed interesting to see how many and how rich this field of images is in the history of philosophy, even among those recognised as hard-nosed analytic or scientific philosophers. So one thinks of Locke's under-labourers of science, clearing away the undergrowth of myth and common belief for science. One thinks of the passage in Kant's Critique of Pure Reason, quite flowery and poetic passage where he talks about the philosopher as a surveyor of the island of truth surrounded by the stormy seas of ignorance and prejudice. One thinks of Nietzsche's philosophers of the future, of Descartes' tree of knowledge, and so on. There is a whole field of such images. A third cultural dichotomy that bears on the characterization of continental philosophy concerns the difference between knowledge and wisdom. And here, I'm referring to the idea that Western philosophy, at its very origins among the Greeks, was indeed the love of wisdom. That is, of course, where the term comes from. And philosophy was supposed to tell us what a good life is and how we should live it. In this sense, philosophy was above all practical. And this practical approach was very much central to philosophy, at least up until the early modern period. But it has since been displaced by more technical and more science-oriented concern with knowledge of the world, including the human and biological world of which we're a part. There has, in recent years, been a revival of interest in the classical questions. It's evident, for example, in the popularity of works like those by Alain de Botton and other so-called popular philosophers. But its relevance here is that it's long been thought and sometimes argued that the continental tradition in philosophy, especially perhaps in its phenomenological and existential varieties, that these traditions have been much closer to these classical questions of wisdom about life. So, to quote Simon Critchley again, he says that part, perhaps, of the appeal of continental philosophy is that it seems closer to the grain and detail of human existence. It seems truer to the drama of human life, to the stuff of human hopes and fears, and to the many little woes and wheels to which our flesh is prone. Here too, I think, one shouldn't overestimate the degree to which this is true. Some continental philosophy remains very far from the grain and detail of human existence. I could think of passages in Foucault, for example. While some Anglo-American analytic philosophers engage very closely with such issues, think of the work of Peter Singer. But I want to come back to this point at the end of my talk and suggest that there is, at least, as I said, a grain of truth in this claim.
On ABC Radio National, you're with the Philosopher's Zone, and we're listening to a talk by Paul Patton on continental philosophy, the philosophical traditions of France, Germany, and the Latin world in Australia. But the academy aside, can continental philosophy continue to make a contribution to public debate?
Perhaps the most helpful way to think about continental philosophy was to think of it as a series of overlapping traditions and approaches, each with their own characteristic methods and often with their own paradigmatic problems. And some of these approaches and some of these problems, I think, have been and could be taken up in relation to matters of public concern in Australia. So, for example, one of the problems shared by a number of the traditions, particularly the existential, critical, theoretical and post-structuralist traditions of continental philosophy, involves what is sometimes called the question of the other, or the question of our relation to the other, capital O, or to others, especially foreign others, those very different in language, culture and history from ourselves. And this issue has a long history in continental political thought, from Kant through the phenomenological tradition to 20th century thinkers like Hannah Arendt, and more recently the French philosopher Jacques Derrida, all of whom in different ways have discussed, among other things, what Kant called the cosmopolitan right of individuals to land in a foreign country to be received and treated with decency without penalty. And questions of this kind have been raised in Australia in recent years in relation to illegal immigrants, sometimes within the framework of the question of hospitality as posed by one or other of these thinkers, by Derrida, by Hannah Arendt, by Emmanuel Levinas. And it's a way of asking questions here of quite practical, political and cultural importance. How do we or how should we relate to unanticipated, unexpected arrivals? What are our obligations to those who arrive unannounced and often in great need? And this question of our relation to others, I think, is also one that arguably lies at the heart of the history of the treatment of Indigenous peoples in Australia. It remains at the heart of the unresolved issue of reconciliation, of treaty, or some form of agreement that might establish relations between Indigenous and non-Indigenous Australians on just foundations, as Paul Keating famously said in 1993. And here, this question of relation to the other across deep cultural divides obviously overlaps onto this question of justice. What in this colonial or post-colonial question does justice toward the other mean? Contemporary philosophical approaches to the question of justice tend to consider it in what are called distributive terms. They think of justice in terms of answering the question, how should we distribute socially produced primary goods, or how should we distribute access to ensure that everyone has, if not equal access, then equal access to, or equal access or fair shares of the primary social goods produced in and by social cooperation. And that is indeed an important and legitimate way of thinking about justice. It is a way of thinking about justice, just treatment of the less disadvantaged. It's a way of thinking practically about the enormous differences in access to social goods between Indigenous and non-Indigenous Australians. But at the same time, these kind of distributive approaches that think about justice very much in the present and very much in relation to a given set of primary social goods, they miss a number of important features of the injustice as experienced and felt by colonised Indigenous peoples, not just in Australia. They don't address, for example, the sense of injustice that follows from the belief that colonisation itself was in some sense a violation of the rights of Indigenous peoples. It doesn't address the idea that justice also requires a certain kind of recognition of others, acknowledgement that others have their own conceptions of what is fair and right, and on that basis a willingness to negotiate with those others as equal parties to a relationship, and not simply assume that the question of justice is one that can be answered in the terms of the, in this case, colonising culture. In other words, justice requires some kind of recognition of cultural difference and recognition that differences don't disqualify others from equal consideration. And this is indeed a conception of justice that one finds more commonly in the writings of continental philosophers like Derrida or like Levinas. And it's one that I suggest is very much present, implicit in the current Australian debate. My final example of this kind of contribution also relates to the debate over decolonisation, reconciliation in Australia. And here it involves a further feature of much continental philosophy, namely that it involves a willingness to pose questions about a particular culture or a particular moment in history in which the philosopher finds himself or herself, rather than simply considering philosophy as only concerned with the universal conditions of knowledge, of moral or aesthetic judgment. And if you remember that list of traditions that I read out toward the beginning, here it's particularly the tradition of the German materialist thinkers, Feuerbach, Marx, Nietzsche, and others, who particularly posed questions about history and about the moment in history at which they lived. In Marx's case, obviously, the birth of capitalism. In Nietzsche's case, a history of European culture characterized, as he put it, by the death of God and the problem of nihilism. So it's this idea that philosophy can be, in some sense, a reflection on the present in which we live. And here it's interesting to note, looking back through issues of the Australasian Journal of Philosophy, or the Australasian Journal of Psychology and Philosophy, as it was initially called, to see if there had been any philosophical thought about the problem of colonisation. The answer was no, not very much. But in an article published in 1940 by P.H. Partridge, a former student of John Anderson and a lecturer at the University of Sydney, the date is clearly significant. Partridge canvassed the idea of a social philosophy which would involve more than just the examination of a given disciplinary field or examination of a well-established series of problems, but would also, as he put it, play a role in the evolution of a sustainable culture. Partridge points out that there's a long tradition that includes Hegel and Marx, Nietzsche and Freud, which views philosophy as an important mode of inquiry because it fulfills this function, and here I'm quoting Partridge, of providing the stimulus or direction for a general cultural advance. And he concludes his discussion of the relation between philosophy and science and their role in the culture at large with a call for a social philosophy which might assist in, quoting him again, forming the structure of a stable culture. What struck me about this article was that the French philosopher Michel Foucault, with whom I'm much more familiar, outlined a very similar conception of philosophy at the end of his life in the 1980s. And Foucault situated his own work in precisely the tradition referred to by Partridge, the tradition of Hegel and Marx, Nietzsche and Freud. He added, however, Kant, or at least part of Kant. He took Kant's famous little newspaper article, What is Enlightenment?, to exemplify this way of philosophizing which takes as its object the present moment in history. Foucault says the question that Kant posed in this essay is the question, what is happening now? What is this now which we all inhabit and which defines the moment in which I am writing? And of course, Kant's answer was that, no, we don't live in an enlightened age, but we live in an age in which the process of enlightenment is ongoing. Foucault uses this text of Kant to characterize his own way of doing philosophy, his own particular historical or genealogical way of criticizing the present. And he goes on to suggest that, like Kant in this essay, the focus of his own, Foucault's own genealogical criticisms of the present was always a particular way of breaking with the past, some point at which what was previously considered universal or necessary was now seen, as he put it, to be the product of the singular, of singular contingent and arbitrary constraints. So things that we took for granted or thought were unchangeable. One of Foucault's examples, say, is prisons. What do we do with lawbreakers? Well, we put them in prisons. Foucault wrote a book that seeks to show that this is an idea that arose at a certain time, that it is widely accepted, but contingent, singular and arbitrary, and therefore open to change. So Foucault was less concerned with the question of stability than Partridge, more concerned with this question of change or rupture with the past. But in a sense, I want to suggest that even though neither Foucault nor Partridge ever wrote about the situation of colonized indigenous peoples, the questions they raised are both pertinent to the current state of our efforts in Australia to overcome or to break with our colonial past. The conception of philosophy to which they appeal, this idea of philosophy as reflection on the present, I think, has immediate application to the situation in which we find ourselves. So we might say the significant negative aspect of our present, or the significant aspect of our present which breaks with the past, is the abandonment or the partial abandonment of the principle of terra nullius that was previously regarded as an irremovable foundation of Australian law. The landmark judgments in relation to native title have shown that this too was a product of particular and arguably racist assumptions embedded in earlier decisions of the courts, colonial and British. In other words, the now that we inhabit, we might say, involves re-examining and rewriting the legal terms in which colonisation took place. The emergence of native title jurisprudence and legislation around it has collapsed elements of the colonial past into the present and made these part of the ongoing elaboration of the future. In this context, and in the terms of the conception of philosophy outlined by Partridge and Foucault, we can also envisage a more constructive task, namely the elaboration of concepts that give expression to the decolonisation of Australian law, Australian institutions, and indeed the social imaginary, and that might provide new foundations for a stable and fair society.
Paul Patton, whose talk at the Sydney Writers' Festival was part of the History of Philosophy in Australasia project, organised by the School of Philosophy at Monash University. This has been The Philosopher's Zone, produced by Kyla Slavin and Charlie McCune. I'm Alan Saunders. I'll be back next week.
You've been listening to another ABC Radio National podcast. ABC Radio National, on air and online. with many of our programs available as podcasts or MP3 downloads. All the details at abc.net.au/rn/podcast.